We're going to cover question 118, the Larger Catechism. This is another example of a place where the Larger Catechism has more information. It's getting a little bit more precise than the Shorter Catechism. It's bringing in another idea to think about, another concept that they want you to meditate upon. In particular, the question has to do with governors of families and other superiors. The raising of the idea of superiors here is a little difficult because we're not going to talk about superiors, equals, and inferiors until we talk about the fifth commandment. When we get to the fifth commandment, we'll talk about the difference and the different duties and responsibilities that superiors have, equals have, and inferiors have. But when we talk about duties of superiors, we're going to delineate, we're going to set out the case for what it is a superior needs to do with respect to observing and keeping holy the Sabbath day, setting it apart so that we observe that period of time in meditation upon religious, spiritual matters. So, question 118, why is the charge of keeping the Sabbath more specially directed to governors of families and other superiors? The answer is, the charge of keeping the Sabbath is more specially directed to governors of families and other superiors because they are bound not only to keep it themselves, but to see that it be observed by all those that are under their charge, and because they are prone oft-times to hinder them by employments of their own. So there are three reasons, which we're going to talk about, three points that they have in mind as to why. But we want to talk first about this idea of governors of families and superiors. And this idea of why this commandment is specially directed. The commandments are directed to everyone. And so it's really talking about a super added obligation. Superiors have an additional obligation that's been added to the obligation that belongs to every single person with regard to the commandments. If you're a superior in a particular type of relationship, and we will talk about types of relationships, you bear a peculiar or special obligation to those that are under you, to those with regard to whom you possess some kind of authority. That relationship bears some sort of authority in that relationship. Primarily, we're concerned about the relationship that parents have to children, but it's not limited to that. Ministers to churches, magistrates to nations bear a very similar relationship that parents do to children when we talk about this kind of relationship that we have in view here. So we want to think about that relationship in those terms. It is a superadded obligation. It's a special or peculiar obligation that's been piled on top. Something else that you have to keep in mind. So the Larger Catechism wants to direct you to think about this. And the reason this appears in the Larger Catechism and not in the Shorter Catechism has to do with the purpose that the Shorter Catechism has versus the Larger Catechism. The Shorter Catechism is written to instruct people generally. The Larger Catechism is designed to be much more theologically precise, to be more specific. So whereas the Shorter Catechism deals in generalities, what we would call universals. The larger catechism very often wants to point out specifics, peculiarities, special distinctions that exist. And so that's what we're going to talk about here. Question one, then, to whom is the charge of keeping the Sabbath specially directed? The answer is, the charge of keeping the Sabbath is directed more to those who are governors of families and other superiors. All right, Exodus 20, verse 10.
Exodus 20, 10. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates.
Notice the commandment begins like all the other commandments, saying thou, that is you, too, right? Very direct. You. But it moves from that to talking about your son, your daughter, your manservant, your maidservant. It begins to talk about people who bear a relationship under you. Their relationship in life is subsequent to you. You bear a peculiar responsibility to those people. And this is the only commandment that has this additional dimension. None of the other commandments move from you to other people like this. This commandment alone is concerned with you and your relationship. And this is in a large part because the fourth commandment has a conserving effect on societies. When we talk about societies of people, companion, right? Company. Those people in association, that this commandment is a cohesive bond that moves from generation to generation. All commandments affect people generationally, but this commandment binds one generation to another. Because in this commandment, all generations together are focused on soulish or spiritual concerns. You know, your concerns differ in life. What you do 6 days a week, they differ depending on whether or not you're a parent or a child, whether or not you are the master or the servant in some way, whether or not you are the ruler or the citizen. That changes 6 days a week. But on one day a week, all souls, God says, are mine. And so there is an equality before God spiritually. Paul says there's no male or female, you know, in Christ. There's no bond or free. That is, we're not servant, you're not a servant or a free man in Christ. Spiritually speaking, there is an equality. But socially, there are still hierarchies of responsibility. And those hierarchies of responsibility are directed to turn everyone to keeping this day. That's what's in view here. So, first of all, governors or masters of families are not only to restrain immoralities in those who are under their care on the Sabbath day, but they're to lay their commands on them to engage them in the worship of God herein, as they expect a blessing from him on their undertakings. Look at Joshua 24, 15.
Joshua 24, verse 15. And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, Choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord.
Superiors are, in any relationship, are under an obligation to make choices which affect everyone under them. Fathers make decisions that affect everyone in the household. Rulers of nations make decisions that affect everyone in the country. Ministers make decisions that affect everyone in their church. Business owners make decisions that affect everyone that works for them. You know, when this happens, it's not unnatural. This is a natural order of things. You know, we can't escape. If the president does something crazy, we very often get blamed for it. You know, we go overseas, people hate Americans because American presidents act foolishly all around the world. We get blamed for it. No matter how much we don't like what they're doing, we get blamed for it. Okay? The same, it's a principle, and people understand this. By nature, people understand that you do bear some responsibility for the way your nation behaves around the world. You pay for it in some respects. You don't get even some of the personal respect that you would get just as an individual, because you're not an individual. You're always coming from somewhere, going somewhere. And so when there's that kind of problem at an international level, it causes you a problem when you want to go somewhere where your nation is involved in some turmoil. It causes you trouble. Joshua says, as for me and my family, we're going to serve the Lord. He makes that decision for his family. He charts a course. He commends that course as a ruler in Israel. He sets an example and then commends that course of behavior to the rest of the nation. When national leaders misbehave in their personal lives, you know, when Bill Clinton was running around and behaving and acting the fool, a lot of people said it doesn't matter what politicians do in their personal lives. No, it does. It's setting an example. Joshua set an example for the entire nation of Israel. When rulers behave, people in high places behave in a way that undermines the dignity and authority that they ought to have and ought to be exerting, when they don't exercise moral restraint in their own lives, it's hard for them to enforce or expect there to be order in a general sense in society. The less orderly these rulers are in their personal lives, the more disorder societies tend to face socially. All right, that's the very reason. And the Lord speaks to the honor of Abraham when he acknowledges his resolve to command his children to worship and serve God. Look at Genesis 18, verse 19.
Genesis 18, verse 19. For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him.
The Lord will bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him. God says, I know Abraham. And what does he say, I know? I know he will command his children. I know that. That's important. He's going to command his children to do what's right. Superiors are required by the very law of nature to seek what is best for those who are under them. You know, we look at it as unnatural for people to have children and then not to take care of them. Why? Because we expect parents to care for their children. We expect superiors to have a concern for those who are under them. It's unnatural when business owners don't take an interest in their employees or people who are working for them. There's an unnaturalness in that. They should want their welfare because their welfare is tied up with the welfare of those people who are working with them and for them. It's unnatural for national leaders to throw their people into wars of attrition where people are simply being killed to maintain an empire without concern for what it's doing to the nation. It's unnatural behavior, which is exactly why in Calvinistic political theory, this idea of resistance to tyranny shows up. The French Huguenots and the Scottish Presbyterians resisted tyranny at every point because it was unnatural. It's unnatural when the leader, the ruler, does not study what is good for those who are under them. And when people behave contrary to nature, they need to be restrained. They're insane in their sin, and they must be restrained. They should not be allowed to continue in that course. Right? God says he knows Abraham. Why? Because he's going to seek the best for his children. He's going to do what is necessary to instruct his children so that they understand this principle of worshiping the true God. They don't get themselves involved in all of this pagan idolatry. They're not going to go off into doing things like sacrificing their children to Molech, which is really a corruption of the Hebrew word malak for king. It's Molech worship is king worship. In the ancient world, people either worshiped the true God or they tended to worship their leaders. Abraham was going to teach his children to worship God, to turn their attention from themselves, outside of themselves, to seek objective standards of morality and behavior. Now, this charge then demands the worship of God in families. And the reason is, first of all, the light of nature teaches men to yield honor to the founders of those societies to which they belong. And God is the founder of families, or houses, as the word is, baitah in Hebrew. Psalm 68, verse 6.
God setteth the solitary in families. He bringeth out those which are bound with chains, but the rebellious dwell in a dry land.
God sets the solitary, or those who are alone, in families. Literally the word baita, houses, it can mean any kind of society. I'm driving back today, I passed the synagogue. It was called Beit Israel, the House of Israel. It's a congregation. It's a society. Every group, in some sense, is, in Hebrew thought, Beit. It's a house. It's a company. It's an association, a society. All right? And men in particular, when we're talking about families, from the beginning, God, and we'll talk about this more when we get to the seventh commandment, but we know that God brought the woman to the man. God presided over the first marriage. And God is the one who took the solitary man and gave him a help that was fitted for him. There's a peculiar dynamic between men and women that God created where there is a mutual helping. Each has a peculiar need for the other. Again, this is why homosexuality is unnatural. There's a lack of understanding. People demonstrate in their very behavior a lack of understanding of this need that people have when they behave in that way. Because men and women need each other. God is the one who made them that way. And because he is behind all of this, he's the founder, just like any other society. If you go into a number of different groups, if you happen to get yourself involved with different clubs and voluntary associations that men enter into in different capacities in life, they tend at some point to honor someone who had something to do with the foundation of that society. Colleges are very well known, universities, for doing this. They endow chairs, positions of teaching, and they'll name them after some previous instructor who lived and taught at one point in that department, or someone of renown. You know, we name the capital of this country Washington. Why? Because of George Washington. It's something natural to societies. De Gaulle gets special attention, right, in France because of this. I mean, the British do the same. Everybody does this, right? We name cities after these people. We name airports, churches, buildings. We just honor them all over the place. And the whole point is here. The family is founded by God, and we ought to honor God and the family. That's what's at the root of all of this. All right, the second thing is that the light of nature teaches masters of families and societies to use all proper means for preventing hurt to the family. And family prayer, family worship, is one means for keeping from danger. Look at Jonah 1, 4, and 5.
Jonah 1, verse 4 and 5. But the Lord sent out a great wind into the sea, and there was a mighty tempest in the sea, so that the ship was like to be broken. And the mariners were afraid and cried every man unto his God, and cast forth the wares that were in the ship into the sea to lighten it of them. But Jonah was gone down into the sides of the ship, and he lay and was fast asleep.
God sends a tempest into the sea. Jonah, as we know, is the reason God is seeking these people in the boat. Right? But family, what do they do? These are heathens, heathen mariners. These aren't the people of God. These are just regular Gentiles. And they pray. Why do they pray? Because deep down inside, this is what everyone does when they're in trouble, when they need to be rescued from danger. Right? It's part of proper leadership. A proper sense of authority and responsibility to recognize the danger that we all stand in at all times and the need that we all stand in at all times to be rescued from it. And so even the light of nature teaches that making supplication, praying to God is a good thing to do. Most people, even atheists, tend to pray when they're in trouble. They may not admit it later if they survive, but they tend to pray. All right? Been on an airplane and they hit a turbulence and the plane starts dropping, everyone gets quiet. And the reason everyone gets quiet is everyone is praying on that plane right then. No matter how big an atheist they think they are, they're praying or they're asleep. Okay, number three, the light of nature teaches all men to do all that they can to promote the good of their families with respect to all things pertaining to this life. And shall it not teach them then to use means to preserve and further their eternal well-being? Look at Proverbs 22:6.
Proverbs 22, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it.
This is the very thing that Abram is commended for, that he's going to train his child. It's natural for parents to want their children to do well in life. And most parents try in to the best of their ability to position their children for what they think will be helpful in life. Now, as a parent, I acknowledge we don't always get it right. You know, you have to remember we're doing it from a very limited point of view, and we are fallible creatures. But we're trying. We generally don't do things to our children that are meant to harm and bring harm to them. If we're doing that with respect to this life, shouldn't we, if we really thought about it, be very concerned about our eternal well-being? Not just time here and now, but eternity, which is a long time. All right, for nature's light directs even the heathens to have their household gods. Look at Genesis 31, 30.
Genesis 31, verse 30. And now, though thou wouldest needs be gone, because thou sore longest after thy father's house, yet wherefore hast thou stolen my gods?
Laban, when he's chasing down Jacob and Rachel, he is fuming mad. Because Rachel has taken his household gods. He had household gods. Now, this makes us ask the question, if heathens observe this principle, that they have household gods, shouldn't Christians be concerned to worship God in their homes as well? Shouldn't they be concerned about this idea of worship in their homes? The pagans have from time immemorial. It's only in post-Christian Western culture that men have become materialistic and atheistic in their family lives. Even the heathens didn't do this. Now, I know a lot of modern culture says, well, that's just superstition. Why should we do this? They don't understand a number of these greater questions regarding the source of life. But this idea that we have families that have no gods, you know, the United States was the first nation in recorded history that declared itself as a secular state. France was second. But the United States started this point of view that there was no, that the nation had no interest in religion. And this was the result of Renaissance deistic thinking, which sought to make a radical separation between church and state, between what was secular and sacred. It drew a line, a sharp line between the two. So much so that since the late 1700s, if anyone who ever lived prior to that were to come back and be able to see what we're doing, it would make no sense to them. We are an anomaly in the history of humanity. Postmodern or post-Christian modern Western culture. We don't understand the enemy that we have in Islam because we think in totally in materialistic terms. So we don't understand people who, they don't hate us because we're rich. They hate us because we're godless. They hate us because we're immoral and wicked. You know, Islam refers to America as the great Satan. And from a religious point of view, they may have a point. When we go around the world and behave in immoral ways, we behave as if we set the rules all over the world. And we got this, to, you know, in some extent from the British. But we behave in a way that we're dictating to everyone around the world what we think is right and we think is wrong. We have no recourse to a sense of higher right and wrong. America did a lot to destroy the strength of Christianity and the cohesion of Christendom in Western culture. You know, we like fundamentalists in this country like to point at Europeans and say they're the godless and they're this and they're that, but it's the stupid, mindless version of Christianity that we've ginned up in this country that makes absolutely no sense of the world to most people who are rational, that makes Christianity so absolutely repugnant. And it just doesn't seem to have a point of view to offer in counterpoint to Islam. You would think that modern people would not be drawn to Islam, but men are inherently religious, and they're eventually going to return to some kind of worship. We all worship deep down inside. We need that. And that's not going away. If Islam is offering a cohesive view, they're going to be the ones who get the converts. And we see secularists in Western cultures now converting in record numbers to Islam. It should be frightening. And the churches are doing nothing about it because Christianity is stupid. Modern Christianity is stupid. It does not, it's uprooted itself from its history, and it has no bearing, and it means nothing. It's become irrelevant to most people's lives. And I understand why most people find it irrelevant. It presents itself that way. It used to be that the most intelligent and the best were drawn to the church and were utilized on behalf of the church because men understood that life is at root a spiritual struggle. But in a struggle between the materialistic West and the spiritual world of Islam, the West will lose. Unless there is some kind of reviving, the West will lose because materialistic people have only this life to look forward to. They're not going to make the sacrifices necessary to fight back and to fight what these people are willing to do. These people are willing to die for their faith. We have people in the West who aren't even willing to die for anything. Right? The heathens can teach us something. Religious people who are non-Christian can teach us something. We've lost a lot, and we need to pay attention to that. The fifth thing is that the command to prayer to pray everywhere and with all manner of prayer includes families. Look at 1 Timothy 2:8 and Ephesians 6:18.
1 Timothy 2:8. I will therefore that men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting.
Ephesians 6:18. Praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, and watching thereunto with all perseverance and supplication for all saints.
We're told to pray everywhere. We're told to pray everywhere, and that means and must include families. But it includes more than that. And this command, the fourth commandment, includes more than just governors of families. Amongst the superiors, we can account as well ministers whose duties extend to the rule of the church. Look at 1 Timothy 3, 4, 5, and 12.
First Timothy 2:8. I will therefore
3, 4, 5.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got by myself there. It's 3, 4, and 5. Excuse me. 1 Timothy 3:4-5. One that ruleth well his own house having his children in subject with all gravity. For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God?
12.
And verse 12. Let the deacons be the husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their own houses well.
Ministers are accounted amongst those who've worn well or orderly. Rule is supposed to be orderly. It's supposed to introduce this idea of order into the lives of people. When we are in a society, there's need for order. We can't all speak at once. We can't all have the dinner plate at once. In churches, the same thing happens. If you don't have some semblance of order, if you can't maintain it in your house, you certainly can't maintain it in a church setting. And this is precisely why, when we talk about people moving into other settings, there needs to be an ability to set rules, to introduce order, so that chaos isn't reigning everywhere. You know, we do simple things in society. We have stop signs, traffic lights, and things like that to order traffic. That's what superiors are doing in all of life, and that's what ministers are doing in the church. They're introducing this idea of order. They're helping direct things so that every person has the ability to be on the same page. We can all do the same thing. There's somebody who's saying, we're going to sing this now together. We're going to read this now together. I'm going to speak to you about this. If we're all reading different things, if we're all singing different things, it's chaos. There's no harmony. The purpose of superiors in a society is to bring about harmony. And this is precisely where, when people fail at this, you know, we can't really remove them so much in families. It's harder to do that. But we should be very willing to remove them in churches and in nations when they fail in these ways. So the difference between a well-run business and a poorly run business has to do with harmony. All right, second, magistrates and other civil rulers whose duty includes the keeping holy of this day. Look at Nehemiah 13, 15, and 17.
Nehemiah 13, verse 15. In those days saw I Judas, some treading wine in Judah, some treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in sheaves and lading asses, as also wine, grapes, and figs, and all manner of burdens which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I testified against them in the day wherein they sold victuals. Verse 17. Then I contended with the nobles of Judah and said unto them, what evil thing is this that ye do and profane the Sabbath day?
Just as it's the duty of governors of families and ministers, and it's also the duty of magistrates or civil rulers to see that there is that kind of harmony. The purpose of the blue laws that we used to have in this country, in fact, I don't know if you remember, but in Nova Scotia, they rescinded their blue laws. Was the end of 2003. They had blue laws there. Everything was shut down on Lord's Day. Nothing. They had one pharmacy opened. I think Germany still actually observes some form of blue laws. It does make, whether people like it or not, it does make for a more harmonious society. Germany has, by doing this, Germany has always managed, and they've done something probably no other European nation could have done as well. That is, when East and West Germany were reunited, they assimilated all of those people who had been brought up under communism into their nation with very little dissent. That's a very, very difficult thing to do. But they did it. And one way they did it is they have this principle of harmony, and part of it in Germany has to do with these laws. They shut down everything one day a week. You have one pharmacy open in your town in case somebody's sick. You've got a doctor on call in the smaller towns. Now, I'm not saying that that Germany is more religious or anything else, but just from a natural standpoint of producing harmony, it does tend to bring about a rhythm to the life of the German people. And if you've ever seen them march, they march with a rhythm that nobody that they're marching into wants to see, right? The Germans have a rhythm. But we want to make sure that we understand that this charge is directed to superiors for that very purpose. What we're seeking is more than just that kind of national harmony. We're seeking a spiritual harmony. We're seeking a point where, again, as the Lord says, all souls are mine, where we can come together and have a point at which we all occupy the same place before God. That we pause and reflect upon that. Because our eternal well-being depends on that. So everybody, every superior in society, from heads of households to magistrates, should be concerned. And if the government was really concerned about your safety, they would observe the Sabbath day for a number of reasons. Not just the benefit to your physical health, which it would do, but spiritually, morally, all of these things can conduce themselves to a better organized, a more harmonious society. We should be concerned about that. So that's why the superiors are counted under this command. All right, the second question we want to talk about are, what are the duties of superiors with regard to the Sabbath day? And the duties of superiors with regard to the Sabbath day are, first of all, to promote, second, to procure, and third, to preserve the sanctification of the day. So, andro sacra, right? Make it sacred. Yeah. Sanctification of the day. Jeremiah 17, 20-22.
Jeremiah 17, verses 20-22. And say unto them, hear ye the word of the Lord, ye kings of Judah, and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem that enter in by these gates. Thus saith the Lord, take heed to yourselves, and bear no burden on the Sabbath day, nor bring it in by the gates of Jerusalem, neither carry forth a burden out of your houses on the Sabbath day, neither do ye any work, but hallow ye the Sabbath day, as I commanded your fathers.
Jeremiah is a very good example of what we're talking about. These are the things that superiors ought to be concerned about. They really should not ask the propriety of those under their command, their power to command, as Cain did at another time. Look at Genesis 4:9.
Genesis 4, verse 9. And the Lord said unto Cain, where is Abel thy brother? And he said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper?
Cain answers God and says, am I my brother's keeper? The entire Bible answers with a resounding yes. You are your brother's keeper. The point of the parable that Jesus tells of the Good Samaritan is to say, yes, you have a responsibility to help people, to promote their welfare, to do things that will help them. Sometimes it's not always what they think, but that means that you have a responsibility to gain an understanding of what it is they really need, what it is they ought to do. And very often children don't understand why parents punish them, why parents restrict them, why parents are doing the things or enforcing the things that they're enforcing. From a child's point of view, it makes no sense very often. But as you grow older, a lot of times as you grow older, it becomes more apparent why your parents wanted you to do this or not to do that. You begin to realize that when I was 12 years old, I really didn't understand the way the world works. Superiors are to do this with regard to their inferiors at every level, whether we're talking about families, ministers, magistrates. They should not have this attitude that Cain had, "Am I my brother's keeper?" Yes, you are. If you're a superior in a relationship, you have an obligation. You should be very concerned. You should be very concerned about the well-being of everyone around you, but especially those over whom you exercise some influence or authority. Right, he that does not hinder another's sin, when he may, in fact, commands him to sin. Look at Jeremiah 23:14.
Jeremiah 23:14. I have seen also in the prophets of Jerusalem a horrible thing. They commit adultery and walk in lies. They strengthen also the hands of evildoers, that none do it, doth return from his wickedness. They are all of them unto me as Sodom and
Jeremiah, again, complains that the people of Israel have become as the inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah. Why? Because they are behaving in a way that allows what we would call a libertine spirit to prevail. Anything goes. There's no rule. There are no moral restrictions. It's libertine. You can do whatever you want, regardless of whether or not it's right or wrong. They become as Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, does this mean that the prophets and the superiors in Israel have been commanding them to sin? No. But my point is this: when you do not hinder the sin of another who's under your influence or authority, when you don't do what lies within you to hinder them, you might as well command them to do it, because you're leaving them loose to do this unrestrained. You're preventing it in no way. You're presenting no obstacle. And the great thing that an effective ministry would do in any society is present obstacles in the forms of argumentation. Ministers should be expostulating, arguing with the people about their behavior, presenting a different worldview. They're getting, 6 days a week, they're getting this worldview that is post-Christian, modernist, materialist, and secular. Ministers should be educated enough to present another point of view. At least challenge it. Don't concede this entire territory. All right, the promotion of the Sabbath stands in two things. First of all, making men aware of the obligation of the keeping of this set time unto God. Look at Exodus 34:21.
6 days thou shalt work, but on the seventh day thou shalt rest. In earing time and in harvest thou shalt rest.
And secondly, actively encouraging the keeping of the set time for a holy rest unto God. Deuteronomy 5:12-14.
Deuteronomy 5, keep the Sabbath day to sanctify it, as the Lord thy God has commanded thee. 6 days thou shalt labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God.
In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thine ox, nor thine ass, nor any of thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates, that thy manservant and thy maidservant may rest as well as thou.
Okay, so when I say promoting, when it's the duty of a superior to promote, what do you do when you're promoting something? Well, you're doing two things, right? The first is you have to make people aware of it. If you're promoting an event, if you're promoting something, you have to raise people's awareness. This is why Paul says, how shall they hear except someone tell them? Now, people aren't going to just come to this by themselves. Most people are not going to come to the truth by themselves. They need to be prodded. Plato acknowledges this. Jesus himself uses that Socratic method of asking questions so that you can reflect on the answer. Promoting something means, first of all, raising the awareness. But secondly, when you promote something, you want to be active in encouraging people to that thing. Right? You want to direct them to what it is you are promoting. That's part of the promotion. You don't just simply want them to all of a sudden be aware, oh, I have this product and it's for sale, but you want to move them to buy it if you're in business. You know, advertising does this all the time. That's what superiors ought to be doing with this religious knowledge. Again, why is it that God commends Abraham? Because he knows Abraham is going to command his children. That is, he's going to make them aware of the truth. He's going to encourage them in the truth. He's going to encourage them to pursue the truth. For their well-being here and forever. But also knowing that their well-being helps everyone. You know, when the general population is moral and truthful, there's an honesty, a transparency, there are a lot less problems. We have a lot less problems at every level of society, whether we're talking about families, the economic or social life of a people. We have a lot less problems. We're already going to be dealing with this idea of original sin. We have this sin that has to be mortified. But by meditating upon these commands, we are enjoining people to consider living their lives a different way. To consider the benefit, not only to themselves, but to everyone else. And ultimately, if you believe, you're doing it to the glory of God. Okay, so we need then to understand, first of all, superiors have a duty to promote the Sabbath keeping, but the second is the procuring of these ends may be seen in the duty, first of all, to take care that this time be marked off so as to be kept holy. Luke 23, 54, and 56.
Luke 23, verse 54. And that day was the preparation, and the Sabbath drew on. And verse 56. And they returned and prepared spices and ointments, and rested the Sabbath day according to the commandment.
So, procuring, superiors procure the keeping of the Sabbath by helping people mark off that time. When you were children, you needed help getting dressed. You needed help brushing your teeth. You needed help cutting up and eating, cutting up your food and eating it. You needed help. Spiritually speaking, we all need help. We need help doing what's right. Remember, by nature, we're born sinners. So we need help. We need guidance. We need this kind of help from those people who are our superiors. When they're not helping us, it makes it harder for us. You know, it's harder coming into any kind of religion when you haven't been raised that way. It's harder moving from a position of irreligion into an embracing of Christianity because you haven't been given those kind of lines, those borders, the barriers. Nobody's helped you set them. They didn't understand. It makes it easier to move in a course or channel of believing and behaving yourself in a moral way when you've been brought up in that way. That's one thing a superior should be doing, is procuring that for you. And that can happen, again, not only at the family level, but it can happen at a national level. It should be happening. Again, one reason Islam is so effective worldwide is because in Islamic nations, they behave this way. It's going to be very difficult for a bunch of materialists, I tell you, to fight back when they become the majority. It's going to be very hard because you have a bunch of people who have no social cohesion. They're not stuck together. There's no real society. They're individuals who happen to be together at the same place at the same time. But there's no bond. There's no spiritual unity. Islamic people have a spiritual unity which presents a formidable, not formidable, formidable challenge. Second, to affect the keeping of his day by underscoring its sanctity by his added authority. Nehemiah 13:21.
Nehemiah 13:21. Then I testified against them and said unto them, why lodge ye about the wall? If ye do so again, I will lay hands on you. From that time forth came they no more on the Sabbath.
Procuring the Sabbath not only means setting aside time, but there is an enforcement. I mean, parental authority is about enforcing certain rules, certain order on your life. You know, the very reason you even were educated was because somebody imposed on you this restriction of your freedom to educate you. They inflicted on your freedom a violation that in the end, if you become educated, you realize actually made you more free. At first, when you first went to school, it felt like prison. Sitting down and having to learn anything at first, the discipline that's required feels restrictive. This is why it requires there to be this added authority. There has to be a willingness to restrain people. Why? Because at first, people don't really get it. In time, more and more people do. But at first, we're like children. We don't understand. We don't see the value. It's only the value becomes apparent in time. It just takes time. The value of things in general in life, things that are really valuable become more and more apparent over time. You know, we see, we can appreciate. They grow in value, in our appreciation of their value. All right, the third thing is to use all means to encourage the keeping of this day unto the Lord. Nehemiah 10:31.
Nehemiah 10:31. And if the people of the land bring ware or any victuals on the Sabbath day to sell, that we would not buy it of them on the Sabbath or on the holy day, and that we would leave the seventh year and the exaction of every debt.
So not only can we add authority, but there are things that we can do to discourage. And what is one of the things that Nehemiah talks about? Well, look, people who bring things, we're just not going to buy it. We're not going to encourage them. Very often, even in areas where we don't have direct authority, we have some indirect authority or influence. But when the churches empty out on Sunday, and everybody goes out to eat, for example, they've encouraged all kinds of Sabbath breaking. When they turn this into their day of commerce, they've encouraged a number of people to stay away from any spiritual pursuit. They're bribing them in an unhealthy way. They're appealing to a baser interest. They're appealing to their covetousness, the greed factor. You know, I want, I want, I want. Well, we all want, we crave. We crave because we're here, we're in this world. And sin, that principle of covetousness Paul talks about, is a sense of I want, I desire. But we can procure a better keeping of Sabbath by things that we do or don't do. We can encourage or discourage. When we encourage people in any sin, by patronizing it in any way, we're commanding these people to continue sinning. And so in this case, in particular, it behooves superiors in particular to be very careful about this. You know, why is it we try to shut down and quiet everything on Lord's Day? To discourage people who are less circumspect. You know, if every time I picked up the phone on Lord's Day, it was spiritual conversation, I probably wouldn't turn off the phone on Lord's Day. But the point is that most people who are calling don't even have, remotely have, the same sense of obligation. And it turns into a distraction. Better to turn it off. Better to put it aside. Better to stay away from these things. If they can't be turned to a profitable use, or if they're encouraging someone else, we need to be very careful. We need to think about not only what it is we're doing, but what it is we're doing that might influence or lead other people in a direction away from the direction we should be trying to encourage them to go. Right. The third is the preserving of the Sabbath, which includes, first of all, protecting this set time for its intended use. Look at Ezekiel 20, verses 12 and 20.
Ezekiel 20, verse 12. Moreover, also I gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between me and them, that they might know that I am the Lord that sanctify them. And verse 20. And I'll hallow my Sabbaths, and they shall be a sign between me and you, that ye may know that I am the Lord your God.
Okay, so if we're going to preserve something, how do we preserve something? We preserve something, first of all, by protecting it. If we're going to preserve an endangered species, which is what the Sabbath has become in post-Christian Western culture, right? What do? We first have to protect it. We have to be more careful in some respects about what we do, perhaps, than what people did when it was quite commonplace. We need to think about that. We need to be careful, take very good care that this time is protected, that we shut out all of these other concerns. You know, we have to erect hedges, walls, barriers that people didn't need to do 150 years ago in this country. Because 150 years ago, we wouldn't be insisting on this so much. We wouldn't need to. Most people would understand the principle. They would be living it. It would have been commonplace in most towns. All right, the second is keeping or maintaining it without regard to change, whether personal or social. Look at Ezekiel 44, 24.
Ezekiel 44, verse 24. And in controversy they shall stand in judgment, and they shall judge it according to my judgments, and they shall keep my laws and my statutes in all mine assemblies, and they shall hallow my Sabbaths.
Keeping, when we're preserving something, we not only protect it, but we have to keep it or maintain it. And that without regard to change. In other words, if we're going to preserve an endangered species, we also try to do what? We try to maintain its habitat. We try to leave it untouched, unchanged. And we set aside game preserves. We set aside lands to restrict usages. We do this in order to protect and also to see that there isn't any change. In other words, bears generally don't do well in the middle of cities. If we want to preserve bears, we have to present and preserve bear habitat, right? We have to keep it unchanged. And so there's a sense in which preserving the Sabbath day seems to be a retrograde or a primitivistic impulse. We're removing ourselves from technology. We're removing ourselves from all of these conveniences of modernity. It seems like we're going in the other direction. But when you understand that technology does not help your spirit, it may lend comfort to you in this world, it isn't something that's going to it's not going to bolster your spirit. It's not going to help you in that way. Primitive is good. The Puritans got a lot of grief from non-Puritans because they wanted to strip their places of worship of pictures and all kinds of fancy things. They wanted to do that, and it was very primitivistic. It was a very primitive impulse. But their concern was to help you avoid additional distractions. It's very easy for us to attribute some spiritual feeling to something other than a real religious intuition. You know, we feel inspired when we see a beautiful picture. We feel inspired when we hear a beautiful piece of music. It's very easy for us to confuse that kind of feeling of inspiration with a religious sense. And so that's why it needs to be kept without regard to change. We can't let who we are, what we are, where we are dictate the parameters of Sabbath keeping. Third, we have to see that it's kept whole and entire. Exodus 16:29.
Exodus 16, verse 29. See, for that the Lord hath given you the Sabbath, therefore he giveth you on the sixth day the bread of 2 days. Abide ye every man in his place, let no man go out of his place on the seventh day.
The Lord gave Israel 2 days worth of sustenance on that sixth day so that on the seventh day they could rest. There was provision made. Why? To see that the whole day was kept, entire day. That's preserving the Sabbath day. You're preserving it to the very use for which that time ought to be set aside. All right, the third question then, why are they to have this special regard? And this is, I think, is an important thing for people, and particularly, I think this is a point that Americans, we don't like, traditionally Americans don't like authority. We don't do the authority thing. We don't like it. Don't like being told what to do or when to do it. The fact is that superiors occupy a position of headship which we can call a covenantal point of unity. God deals with people not simply as individuals, but as families, as churches, as nations. And so superiors are the point at which there is unity before God in these different situations. Then those who are placed under them in the providence of God are really their responsibility, because they have a responsibility and ought to have a regard to this unity. Look at Exodus 23:12.
Exodus 23, verse 12. 6 days thou shalt do thy work, and on the seventh day thou shalt rest. Thine ox and thine ass may rest, and the son of thy handmaid, the stranger, may be refreshed.
The fact is that the rest, the Sabbath rest, redounds to everything, to all of the society which exists under these covenantal heads, whether in families, in churches, and nations. Right, the guilt of broken Sabbaths is laid to the charge of those in positions of authority. Look at Ezekiel 22:6.
Behold, the princes of Israel, every one, were in need to their power to shed blood.
Ezekiel talks about Sabbath breaking and the shedding of blood. Those who are in positions of authority, superiors, first of all, have a heightened responsibility before God for whether or not God's commandments are kept under them and on their watch. But beyond that, the guilt will fall not only on those who break the law under them, the divine law, the commandments of God, but it will fall upon those superiors who have done nothing to restrain them. And very often parents receive divine chastisement in the disobedience of their children because they've refused to restrain their children. And in like way, God holds not only the heads of families responsible, but ministers of churches, leaders of nations. They will all answer. And they have, on Judgment Day, they have a heightened responsibility. But that doesn't just fall to them, the guilt. Superiors have no power to dispense with any of God's commandments. In other words, contrary, and this is where Luther got in trouble, and this is where the Germans continue to get in trouble. Luther said that the magistrate was above the Ten Commandments. The magistrate, as a magistrate, had the right to act apart from and above the Ten Commandments. The German people, ever since Luther, have had this sneaking suspicion in their minds that when they act as a group, they're above the law of God. This is one reason for German behavior for the last 400 years. Okay? The Reformed churches never embraced that idea. The idea that superiors can dispense from the keeping of God's commandments at any level, why, that's contrary to historic Christian teaching. Your superior can't command you to break God's law and expect that you do it. All right? You don't have any obligation to do it. They have no authority or power to disengage those who are under them from yielding obedience. When judgments fall, in fact, they fall on the whole covenanted society. Look at Ezekiel 20, verse 13.
Ezekiel 20, verse 13. But the house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness. They walked not in my statutes, and they despised my judgments, which if a man do, he shall even live in them. And my Sabbaths they greatly polluted.
Then I said I would pour out my fury upon them in the wilderness to consume them.
Just because your leaders, your superiors, whether in your family, the church, or the state, just because they take it upon themselves to act contrary to the law of God does not give you the right to disregard the commandments of God. Are they going to be held to a higher responsibility as superiors? Yes, but you need to understand, you too will be held responsible. So although we're addressing superiors in this commandment right now, it should never be seen as an excuse for doing whatever they tell you to do. At the Nuremberg trials, the Nazi defense again and again was, we were just following orders. And the Allies said, that is not a moral excuse. It's not an acceptable excuse. Just following orders when you know something is clearly morally wrong will not absolve you before this court. And they hanged the Nazis, or imprisoned them, in the case of Rudolf Hess. It's not an excuse, and we shouldn't view it as an excuse. We should be very careful. Our disobedience is part of filling up the cup of God's judgment against any nation. We should seek to be obedient because our obedience is the very reason. It's the salt that Jesus talks about that salts a society, which preserves it. God wouldn't pour out his wrath on Sodom and Gomorrah until he got Lot out of there. You know, where you are, if you're obedient, God is going to honor that obedience to the benefit of everyone around you, whether or not they realize it. Now, if you're wondering why Western nations haven't been pummeled and haven't received worse than they have so far, is because God is merciful, he's gracious, he's long-suffering, he's patient. No, he's preserved a people. There are a remnant of his people everywhere who are seeking to be obedient. And it's important that they do so, regardless of where everybody else is going. Right, now, the reasons that they're given this special charge are these. First of all, they themselves are required to keep the Sabbath day holy. Psalm 101, verse 2.
Psalm 101, verse 2. I will behave myself wisely in a perfect way. O, when wilt thou come unto me? I will walk within my house with a perfect heart.
I'll behave myself in a wise way. I'll walk within my house with a perfect heart. That is to say, with a complete attention to the command of God. This is the obligation of every believer, to walk before God in that way, to present themselves in that way. And that means that superiors are required to do this as well. It's not enough for parents, for example, to as I don't know how often it happens now, but when I was a kid, it was very common for parents to put their children on these buses that these churches would send around and just send them off. They wouldn't go, but they would send. They wanted to make sure their kids went. That's not enough. God requires more. We have a nation filled with hypocrisy because my generation, to a large extent, was sent into these churches and our parents stayed behind and just simply didn't care to do it. The fourth commandment is binding one generation to another in the observance of this time. We're to keep it as families, right? Second, they're commanded to see that it is observed by all those under their charge and authority by commanding them to refrain from taking their own diversions or seeking their own pleasures upon the Lord's day. Ezekiel 22:26, and Isaiah 58:13.
Ezekiel 22:26. Her priests have violated my law and have profaned mine holy things. They have put no difference between the holy and profane, neither have they showed difference between the unclean and the clean, and have hid their eyes from my Sabbaths, and I am profaned among them.
Isaiah 58:13. If thou turn away thy foot from the Sabbath, from doing thy pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy of the Lord honorable, and shalt honor him, not doing thine own ways, nor finding thine own pleasure, nor speaking thine own words.
Superiors have an obligation, again, to instruct and command those who are under their authority to be observant. Now, again, by nature, we're not inclined to be. By nature, we're inclined to do what we want to do. We don't see the value. We don't see how this is going to serve us throughout our lives. The great delight in obeying God's law comes in time as you see the results of that. It takes time. It's not always something you see the result of at an instant. And again, we live in a country filled with fast food, 24-hour service. Everything gets turned around and has to be done immediately. We want immediate gratification. And God's law is promising gratification which comes over the course of a lifetime and makes dying easier. You know, during the American Civil War, there was a doctor who noted that he could always tell soldiers who had been raised and memorized a shorter catechism because he said they die well. You know, if what you believe doesn't help you in dying, it's really not worth anything because we're all going to die. And the point of all of this is to make dying less burdensome and life more full along the way. That's something that does not immediately appear to most people. All they see, all they hear are the restrictions. They hear, don't do this, don't do that. You can't do this, you can't do that. You know, and that appeal is about as satisfactory as telling a child that it can't have the lollipop until after dinner. We're children. And we need to mature. And God's law in the keeping and the study of all of this is to bring about a maturity. All right, the third thing is that they're to be careful to arrange matters so as not to hinder those under them from keeping of this day holy and holy. Jeremiah 17, 24, and 27. Those are homonyms. Words that sound alike but mean different things. Right? Holy and holy.
Jeremiah 17, verse 24. And it shall come to pass, if ye diligently hearken unto me, saith the Lord, to bring in no burden through the gate of this city on the Sabbath day, but hallow the Sabbath day to do no work therein. Verse 27. But if ye will not hearken unto me to hallow the Sabbath day, and not to bear a burden, even entering in at the gates of Jerusalem on the Sabbath day, then will I kindle a fire in the gates thereof, and I shall devour the palaces of Jerusalem, and it shall not be quenched.
Okay, so the obligation is to see that we set that day apart and we keep it holy. That is, we keep it complete. There is a completeness. We keep the entire day. We give 6 days a week to the concerns of this life. 1 day a week to the concerns of eternity. which ought to be informing the rest of this life. The duty of superiors is to arrange these matters, arrange all matters, so that people who are under their authority are not unnecessarily kept. And we do that by making preparations the day before, by thinking about it, as we'll talk about in a few weeks when we talk about the word remember, but by thinking about it all week long so that we're constantly making provision. We're constantly preparing so that as it gets closer and closer, there's less and less that we need to do that doesn't pertain to that time. So that our order of business during the week focuses more and more toward preparing us for that meditation on the Lord's Day. So Monday is a good day to just give full focus. But as we approach, as we read in Luke 23, as we approach, there's a preparation that they made for the keeping of the Sabbath according to the command. That's what we need to do. That's what superiors ought to do. They ought to help. They ought to make clear and be careful not to overburden people so that they're unable to focus on the things they need to on Sabbath. The last question is, what lesson lessons may we derive from this mention of superiors in connection with this command? The first thing I want to point out is that the keeping of each command encompasses the keeping of all of the commands. Look at James 2:10.
James 2, verse 10. For whosoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend in one point, he is guilty of all.
As I pointed out at the beginning, we're not going to deal with this idea of superiors equals and inferiors till we talk about the fifth commandment. And yet, we kind of need to have an idea of what superior means in order to have a proper perspective on this commandment. So we're going to have to think about this commandment again when we come to the fifth commandment. We're just going to have to reflect back on it a little bit because it does have to do with the relation of superiors to inferiors in this respect. You know, we can't keep any commandment without keeping all of them. We can't break any commandment without breaking all of them. Right? It's impossible then to keep properly any of the commandments without having an understanding of what each one entails. Look at Romans 7:7.
Romans 7:7. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? God forbid. Nay, I had not known sin but by the law. For I had not known lust except the law that said, thou shalt not covet.
The Apostle Paul thought that he kept the law. He was a Pharisee. He thought he was doing a great job keeping the law until he got to that 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet. And he said, when I got to that 10th commandment, sin revived and I died. In other words, all of a sudden I saw that the commandments were not only directed toward my outward behavior, but my inward deportment. Which is why Jesus says, you know, if you look at a woman to lust after her, you've committed adultery with her. If you call your brother Raka, stupid, you're guilty of murder. Now the Pharisees would have thought that was entirely crazy, insane to think that way. But Paul in Romans is confirming what Jesus says in the Gospels, and that is that there has to be a proper inward deportment. We have to be properly spiritually disposed to the keeping of all of the law. Otherwise, we're not really keeping any of it. So this mentioning of superiors, this idea of bringing in superiors, in this fourth commandment is really pointing to the fact that the law is a seamless whole. It's a seamless garment. You can't pull a thread on this garment without unraveling the whole thing. We talked about that before. The people who think that there are only nine commandments now, they think the fourth commandment isn't a moral part of the moral law. They think it was ceremonial. You pull that out and you've just pulled apart the entire Ten Commandments. All right. The other thing is that we have to understand that none can command us to observe any other Sabbath than the Lord's Day under the New Testament. Look at Colossians 2, 16 and 23.
Colossians 2, verse 16. Let no man therefore judge you in meat or in drink or in respect of a holy day or of the new moon or of Sabbath days. And verse 23, which things have indeed a show of wisdom in will worship and humility and neglecting of the body, not in any honor to the satisfying of the flesh.
Okay, again, superiors are to see that they promote and procure and preserve the Sabbath day, but that does not give them a right to set up other Sabbaths or holy days. They don't have God's prerogative to enjoin upon us other times of rest, spiritual rest, or commend them to us. In other words, the Roman Church, Roman Catholicism, has a series, beyond the Lord's Day, they have an entire calendar full of holy days that they've, if you really are careful in reading the catechism and studying what they say, in order to be a Roman Catholic in good standing, you really ought to be taking part in all of these festivals and feast days and holy days and so on. Some of them are actually called holy days of obligation. Right? The only holy day of obligation is the Lord's Day. The church, the state, your parents, nobody has an authority to obligate you to any other day than this. And when they do, it's spiritual tyranny. The reason one reason Protestantism rejects Romanism is this very point. They've taken to themselves this prerogative to go beyond the duty of superiors and usurp the prerogative of the Almighty God in appointing their own days and obligating you. False religions tend to do this as well. They've got their pilgrimages and their Hodges and all of these other things that they require. So we need to be, again, very careful to understand this delineation. You know, Islamic people are required to shut down for a whole month. God hasn't laid upon us anything as remotely ridiculously restrictive as that. All right, next time we'll talk about the things that are prohibited.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at PuritanDownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at PuritanDownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan hard drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan hard drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan hard drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan hard drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwaters Revival Books.